From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, Stephanie Morillo joins the show to talk about the importance of copywriting in user experience design. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by Fostermade, a versatile web development agency specializing in custom application development, content management systems, and user experience design. Through partnerships with designers, agencies, and organizations, Fostermade is committed to building better digital experiences. Visit fostermade.co. to learn more.
Before we get to today's episode, I want to remind our listeners we have a donate link on our site. So if you love Control Click and have a little spending money, consider donating to help us keep the show going. $1, $5, whatever you can spare will help us continue to deliver great content, high quality audio, and transcripts for each and every episode. Now to today's topic. We are excited to have Stephanie Morillo on the show. Stephanie is a Dominican-American writer, musician, and technologist from New York City. She currently serves as the Chief 10X English Syntax Engineer at DigitalOcean, read copywriter, and is passionate about educating the next generation of technologists and writing professionally for tech-minded audiences. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Thanks for having me.
So, Stephanie, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I have been a professional writer for close to 8 years, but I kind of happened in tech accidentally. A good friend of mine started teaching me Ruby on his couch about 4 years ago. And from there, I was like, okay, coding is really cool. I really like technology, started working at startups. And for a while, I thought that I would be a developer. But I kind of realized that what I enjoyed most about development was messing things up and writing about how I managed to make it work. Right. So I realized, you know what, communication is kind of a thing and, you know, tech really needs writers. So I'm lucky in that I found the job that was perfect for me. I'm at DigitalOcean serving as the sole copywriter in the company. And I touch both product and marketing copy. But on the fun side of things, I am a musician. I've been singing for somewhere upward of 16, 17 years, had 10 years of private lessons. And lately, you'll probably find me complaining about Muay Thai and how difficult it is.
Wow.
It's legit. It is the real deal. I'm not there yet, but one day, hopefully. And just reading and writing and just trying to figure out how to get better with writing. I'm a huge writing geek.
That's cool. And when you sent us your bio, you're also the co-founder of a WOC in Tech chat. It's a community of women of color and non-binary people of color. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It started around 1 year and 3 months ago. I had an idea, which I brought up to a friend of mine. Her name is Christina Morillo. We have the same last name, but we're not related. And I told her how great it would be to have a community for women of color. I felt that it was a particular audience that tech had not really talked to specifically. And I found very, very few examples where women of color in particular were called out, whether in scholarships or just in terms of talking about particular underrepresented groups. And I came up with the idea, along with Christina, to create a Twitter chat just to see who was out there. We didn't really know many people. She and I found each other through Twitter, so we thought it'd be a great medium. And we had one Twitter chat and ended up having about 40 to 50 participants. Wow. And a week later, we were approached by the folks at Fun Club, which is an organization run by Ash Dryden and Shanley Kane. Mm-hmm. They said, hey, do you want funding so you can kind of make this into a thing? Mind you, we didn't even know if we were going to have another Twitter chat. And it became something else. It became a grassroots initiative. And the thing that we're probably the most well known for are our free women of color in tech stock photos.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a collection of photos that feature actual technologists who volunteered to be models for us. And they're in actual, you know, startup and workspaces in New York City. We had one at Trello, a photo shoot at Trello, one at Microsoft New York, and one at DigitalOcean. And they're there doing their thing. So we had UX designers there doing their thing. We had founders, you know, entrepreneurs doing their thing. Similarly, we had developers, software engineers, people all along the tech spectrum participate. And so it's actually been really amazing to see, because this was something that was started by two people who had access to internet and a computer and became something completely above and beyond our wildest expectations.
Yeah, Leigh and I have seen those photos. I think we tweeted a link to them a while ago. But I also love on your site that you've been able to sponsor tickets for, you know, women to attend different tech events.
Yes, that was something that came about from my own personal experience. I, on Twitter, about 2014, I found this small conference that I'd never heard of called Madison Ruby that was giving away scholarships to go to one of their conferences. I applied and I was a recipient. It was the first ever tech conference that I'd ever attended. And for about a period of maybe 9 months, I was fortunate enough to apply for tickets on, you know, with diversity scholarships to go to different events. And I was able to meet a lot of technologists that I admired, that I'd known of through the internet. And I remember thinking, wow, this is such a great opportunity because all of the conversations that I was having on Twitter with technologists were coming to life. I was having the opportunity to learn, get exposed to different things. And I really wanted that opportunity to be available to other women of color, mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. since women of color in particular were not really... It was such a small audience. And there was one conference in particular. It was a conference for women engineers. It's called Write, Speak, Code. And they actually had a scholarship for women of color. And I applied and I was a recipient of that. So I was like, you know what? It'd be great to just pay it forward and to give people the chance to travel and to meet new people. Something that, you know, the cost of travel alone can mm-hmm. be prohibitive for many people. So we really just wanted to lower the barrier to entry as much as we could.
Oh, I love it. I really do. That's the kind of stuff that warms my heart, you know, and it's the kind of things that really do change someone's life. I will never forget my first tech conference and how meeting people and kind of building that network got me to where I am today running my own business. And it's getting those opportunities that are so important.
Absolutely. It really just takes that one small opportunity to be the seed that then someone can build a career, a foundation, you know, off of.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would have to say just being invited. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's one of those things where you're necessarily being rejected, but having the extended invite explicitly towards you. You know, I'm Filipino. So mm-hmm. having that type of representation is really important to me because I don't remember who said this quote, but it was someone said, you can't be what you can't see.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
So it's so, so important to just understand that you are welcomed
mm-hmm. absolutely.
In this community. Absolutely.
Needed, not just welcomed, but needed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right. So let's shift to today's topic. I think a great question to start with is to define what copy is and if how it's different from content.
Yeah, absolutely. It was funny. I've been struggling with how to describe copywriting to people, but I actually found a great definition on thecopyblogger.com, which is a really, really great resource. The definition is copywriting is the art and science of strategically delivering words, whether written through print or online media or spoken, that get people to take some form of action.
Mm.
So really, it's about crafting information into messaging that can be used for whatever purpose, whether we want people to engage with us and our brand, whether we want to present them with information like instructions on how to use a specific form of software, how to use our site, all the way down to information that can be used on a marketing website. Mm-hmm. And content, I firmly believe that a content strategist would have a more nuanced definition than me. But copy can be content in the sense that, so content, I see it as assets, as objects mm-hmm. that are there to
right.
inform. They're there to inform the audience or, you know, again, engagement, right? Mm-hmm. So we can have things that are bundled into a content object. Like you can have an Instagram post, right? A video along with the caption. The way that's bundled together, that's both content.
Mm-hmm.
A blog post, which is primarily written text, that's content. And similarly, a video, images, things that have nothing to do with written text can also be content if they're delivered in a specific way. And, you know, if the purpose of it is for people to engage, for people to be informed. So not all forms of content are copy, mm-hmm. i.e., again, multimedia, right? A podcast is considered content, audio, visual. And then not all forms of content are copy. And then not all forms of copy, interestingly, are content. So if we think about Like, if you think about a sign-up flow, right? If you're signing up for a service or a website, the form fields, right? Choose your username, mm-hmm. choose your password, submit, right? Those forms of copy that are so small that we don't really consider them copy, we just consider them part of the page, that's not really content, right? We wouldn't really call a sign-up flow content, even mm-hmm. from a design perspective. Like, you know, would we call the way a sign-up page is designed content? Not necessarily, but nonetheless, it is an object or an asset that we interact with. It's just that the purpose is really, in that particular instance, to guide a user to be able to take a certain action.
And so the copy in that scenario would be like the form field labels or the label on the submit button.
Correct.
Cool. So in terms of our copywriters, content strategists, or copywriting is just getting those the text stuff right, and it's kind of separate from the multimedia element of content?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I'm sure a lot of content strategists will agree with me when I say that no, copywriters are not content strategists per se. Content strategists are not just concerned with, they have like a lot of higher level concerns. So for one is what kind of content needs to be created, right? So they'll come up with a strategy, not just that, the delivery mechanism. So they're interested in, if we're, let's say we're creating a marketing website, right? A content strategist will be concerned with the architecture, right? So how the information architecture of that particular site. And one of the things they might be interested in is also, you know, how we build this site. So are we using a particular content management system? Mm. Are we right. using, you know, a static site generator, all of that stuff? So they're interested in both the editorial, but also the more technical aspects that bring content to life. Mm-hmm. Whereas a copywriter in this particular instance might work with a content strategist or an art director, somebody who's basically the one, somebody that is managing the campaign, and they will work with that person to kind of create and craft the messaging. Mm-hmm. So some content strategists do copywriting as a part of what they do, but they are not necessarily copywriters first and foremost. Mm-hmm. People come to content strategy through different avenues. Some people come through a very like a hard marketing background. Sometimes product designers go into it, and copywriters could go there, but their skill set is a lot broader, and writing is really just one particular part of one, just one aspect of things that they need to know about. I mean, a content strategist would probably also be versed in other forms of delivery. So things like video, working with videographers,
mm-hmm. right.
photographers, they would probably know about social media. So there is a lot more that they think about broadly.
Mm-hmm. And does it go the same way you say sometimes a content strategist may do copywriting? Could a copywriter somehow be involved in content strategy?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. And the short answer is yes. One of the things that I do want to say, though, is that copywriter, especially in the tech industry, is not as well defined a term as it is in like at ad agencies. When we think right, of a copywriter right. and mm-hmm. we know exactly what we're talking about. But in tech, I'm called a copywriter, but I could have a peer that does something similar to me, and they would probably be working on product copy. They might be a UI writer. We might have people with titles like content marketing strategist or content specialist or whatever. And we have similar roles, but we all report to different departments and the organizational structure is different. The short answer is yes. In my particular role, I am able to offer more strategic recommendations or even ask questions that mm-hmm. are specific to a platform. So one of the things that I do is I work closely with the product designer. So definitely delivery, how we're displaying information. These are things that I have to know about. I have to understand, you know, modals. I have to understand, you know, push notifications. I have to understand certain elements that perhaps somebody working on the marketing side won't. And similarly, like I'd want to know on the marketing side, like what analytics are we collecting from our blog? You know, is there a reason why we have a blog hosted on Medium versus, you know, a self-hosted blog or whatever? So yeah, as time has gone on through my particular role, I have kind of had to wear that strategy hat more and more with time.
Mm-hmm. So I'm a little bit curious regarding that, because I feel like that is a common thread in the web industry, regardless of whether you're the copywriter or the strategist or the designer or the developer. You're kind of tasked to kind of, even though you've got your specialty, you're expected to do kind of like overlapping tasks. And in comparison, you kind of mentioned, you know, in an ad agency, it's super clear what the copywriter copywriter does, and that's what they only do. How do you feel in regards to the overlap versus like specialization? Do you think that's actually helping or harming copywriting in the web industry?
That's a really good question. I have strong feelings about having, I really think that when it comes to copywriting in particular, if we could get closer to specialization, I think that's the best way to go. Mm-hmm. For one, not all UX designers, product designers, or developers are interested in the writing aspect. Sometimes it's treated as an afterthought. And there are things about writing that these particular folks, like the people in these particular roles, might not consider. Like our audience, our target audience, like what about brand voice and tone? How does that change depending on, you know, the product or whatever? Do we do any form of internationalization with our copy? You know, like, are we being crass or cheeky? Like, is this very, very clear? Are we being mm-hmm. clear and concise? So when it comes to questions of style, I think that having someone who understands copywriting or just copy in general, someone who comes from a writing background, could probably answer those questions much better than someone who does not have that background. And furthermore, I think that having someone who is responsible for writing that copy means that that copy ends up better, stronger, and we have mm-hmm. somebody championing the experience. Like a company that I think does copy really well is Slack. All of their notifications, the tone, the personality. We can say that Slack has a personality on social media. Slack has a personality in-app, the kinds of notifications that you'll get from your Slack bot. And all of those things are crafted by writers, people mm-hmm. who understand the importance of written language and how people digest what they're reading. So I really do believe that, especially as companies start to scale, that special consideration should be given to building out a team or, you know, a team of one, but certainly someone or some folks who own copywriting.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like what you were just describing now segues nicely into the next question I have is, how does the user experience fit into what the copywriter does? Because what I'm hearing from you is that, you know, a gifted writer, someone who understands language, also has to understand who's reading it.
Yeah, it matters a lot. And I think one of the frustrations that I'm feeling is that it does feel like there's a divide, right? I really think that copy and user experience design are two sides of the same coin. We cannot have a beautiful design without, we could have the most beautiful design in the world, and without any words on it, the user will not know what the hell is going on. Similarly, if I were to just present a whole bunch of text on a site, the user might not necessarily know what's going on or how anything relates to each other. So both of these things are equally important. And I think what I struggle to see is whether UX designers or product designers know how to, I think like it's more about thinking about copy as a separate but equally important part of the design. So one of the things that I recommend to designers is, for example, when you're going to create placeholder copy for your designs, actually write out what you think it should say. Don't put lorem ipsum or any kind of dummy text in it, because that will, for one, show you whether or not your design complements the copy, vice versa. Two, it'll help you see how much space copy is going to need to be able to actually convey whatever information needs to be conveyed. And then you'll get a feeling for what kind of tone you want it to, how the tone of the copy and the tone of the design, right? How these two interplay off of one another. So it's really something that I'd like to see more of. Like a question that I have, and it hasn't been answered for me because I don't have an extensive amount of time working with product designers, is how many product designers and UX testers incorporate messaging in their user testing? Like, do we talk about how clear, like, are we testing against our assumptions? Does sign up mean to us what it means to someone else? Similarly, does submit mean all of those things? Like, are we creating any obstacles for our users with language? Maybe the design is great, but there's something we have to tweak about the copy. So I think really think about it as a part of the design process will help, especially UX designers and product designers that are not writers, but they have to write the copy that accompanies their designs.
So does that mean that, like, best case scenario, copy content should be ready before design? Or do you think it's okay that you might just have placeholder, but with context?
I like the placeholder with context. Personally, especially in my role, because the product designers are working with the stakeholders much more closely than I am. You know, some people might have varying opinions. Like in some projects, I'd like to be looped in right away. In others, I'm okay with it coming down the pipeline. Chances are the more stakeholders and the bigger the project, the earlier in I'd like to be brought on. But I think it's good. I think it's totally fine for a UX designer to have a design ready before copy. I think it's just what it does for the designer. And I think it's really helpful. It really helps them see their design, like how their design would look like in the wild, in the to a user. And then, of course, it gives the copywriter added context. There's nothing worse, I think, than someone coming up to me and saying, hey, can you write this thing? And I have no information. What thing do you want me to write?
True.
What thing do you want me to write? I think this is one thing that's important. And I think even visual designers will understand this. Like, can you create this logo for me? Okay, that's nice. You know, what's the color palette? What company are you? You know, like all of these other questions that I think people don't foresee or understand, all of the actual questions that need to be answered before someone can sit down to write the copy that they want them to produce.
You know, this is really interesting because I feel like you're the first person we've ever set this same question with, saying very clearly that the design helps you write.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So because we have a lot of colleagues of ours who are like content first, content first, content first. And I feel like as a small business, sometimes that isn't always
like
available
never
to us for our clients. So Emily and I do fake copy. Like we do try to make it in context of the client, but you know, we're kind of tasked with trying to put that content in there. And I think you're right. It makes sense. Like how do you write in a black box, right? But if you've got the context of the design already, you've got the idea over like, oh, okay. So there needs to be emphasis on this area, should we have more impactful copy there? Because clearly they're trying to guide the eye there.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, and I feel like I have better conversations with the designers that way. So the way the designers at DigitalOcean and I work together, it varies from designer to designer, but they might send me a Google Doc with the screens of, you know, what the particular flow is, right? And then underneath, they'll indicate that all of the information there is placeholder copy, but then underneath, they'll provide more context. They'll say, you know, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to tell the user, if they sign up for this, you know, it's going to cost this much money. And in the tooltip, we want to indicate that in a tooltip or whatever, right? Which is great, because that means that I then see the flow the way the user does. And I can ask questions, like I can ask things like, space. Like that's something that designers think about. You know, how many lines of space do we need or should we need in order for it to be for the design to work? And for a designer, writing placeholder copy helps them with, you know, helps them visualize it, right? Like if you write Lorem Ipsum text and you give me just 3 or 4 or 5 words of Lorem Ipsum text, but the reality is that I actually need more like 2 lines, there's a dissonance there, right? Like there's a gap. But I think that it helps the designers. It helps them inform their designs. It helps them manage their expectations better. And it also gives me context, because I actually want to see what the user sees. I find that my conversations are much more productive with designers when we have something designed first with placeholder copy. And the understanding is, I know this isn't real copy. I know the tone and all of that isn't what it's supposed to be. They're not trying to impress me with their writing skills. They're just trying to show me, hey, this is kind of what we need it to say. And this is what I have to play with.
So that actually makes me wonder where this sort of fits in. So a model that we often follow with our clients is typically we never have content first. and then we design something with, you know, some copy, and then we give them comps to review and we tweak, and then we begin development. So with your process, is it you and the designer kind of finalizing those comps together with copy, and then you send it as a whole to the client? Or are visual comps and copy hand it over to a client for review as separate items?
They're usually sent to the stakeholder as one item. So the product designer will reach out to me and say, hey, I'm working on this particular project. they'll tell me, I'll usually get all of the tasks and stuff. And it's just because that's the way we work at DigitalOcean. It's not because this is a particular process that we think is the best. It's just how it is. The product designer will come to me and say, hey, I'm working on this particular thing, this particular feature. These are the copy needs. And sometimes they won't send me screens. Sometimes they'll just say, we need to have, it's going to be a modal. We have to have an H1 header. We need to have two lines of subcopy and, you know, a particular, and a CTA, you know, and a button. Mm-hmm. And I can work that way. It's usually when the projects are much bigger and the user flow is much more complicated, or if we're like introducing a new feature, in those instances, I'll need screens to see exactly what the user is seeing. But if it's something like a modal or a notification, but to answer that question, it usually all goes through the designer.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. So why don't we take a little bit of a step back? So if you're approached with a new project, like, you have to do some research in the beginning. So our listener, Luke Rees, asks, what is your research process when creating copy for a new project or client?
Yeah, that's great. One thing that I've been thinking about, so I do freelance on the side, and with one particular client, what I do is first I send them a creative brief, and the creative brief, like a template, and the creative brief will have information like, what is this project? Who is the primary audience? Who is the secondary audience? What is the value proposition? Why are we doing this? What are you hoping the outcome of this particular project is? And there's basically a lot of questions. And the client will then send me those answers back. I'll schedule a call with the client, and then we'll kind of, based on the answers they give me, that usually determines what the conversation is going to be. So I had a client that has like an application performance tool. I'm not very well versed in application performance, but when I sat down with the client, I figured out with them, one thing they noticed is that they had too much information on their landing page. They were trying to figure out how to differentiate themselves from competitors. So I asked them about their customers. I asked them about their current customers, what their current customers like about the product, what potential customers don't know about the product that they think people should know about their product, and talk to them about really like what the purpose of this landing page was. And then I thought about their product, and they actually were great. They gave me a list of competitors, right? People that were in that particular space. And I looked at the different pages, and then I was like, well, you know, we haven't been talking about the fact that this is an application performance tool for PHP applications. Like, a lot of these other application performance tools work with a variety of languages and stuff, but it might be awesome if you were really, like, if you really told people that this is about PHP. And one of the things that the client does is when you sign up for a free trial, they will send you 3 test applications in different PHP frameworks. So Magento, WordPress, and I forget what the other one is, but that's actually really cool. It lets a customer know who has a PHP application that this particular tool was built with their needs in mind. So at this point, I had no idea what the design was going to be. This was actually something that was content first. So they actually asked me for recommendations of what the sections could be and what the actual architecture of this landing page was. So I came up with recommendations based on our conversations. And then I saw what other competitors were doing just to understand, not really because I wanted to copy anything, but just because I really wanted to understand how people presented their key differentiators. So I was the one who created the sections. I created the headers for them, the CTAs, and then I went back and forth with the client until we made sure that the messaging was correct. So I did do research on what application performance was, all of the particular features, and then I read a lot of from what their competitors were doing. And then I always made sure to go back to the client to ensure that everything I said was accurate. Technical accuracy is huge for me. So there's only so much that I could be expected to know about application performance, but I definitely wanted to make sure that what I said made sense and that, you know, it didn't seem like I was just, you know, pulling it out of thin air. So yeah, so I did do quite a bit of research for that. The client was great in that they front loaded all of the information through a creative brief. They gave me a list of competitors. They were very clear about what their needs were. And yeah, and I was able to create the copy and also the architecture that kind of informed what the final design of the landing page would look like.
And so this creative brief, you mentioned it's a template. Do you utilize any other templates or resources for your process? Something to, I don't know, maybe keep you on message, keep you on point of what the goals of the project are?
Yeah. One of the things that I'm building out now, it's funny that it's taken me so long to do this, but it's more than halfway done, is a comprehensive style guide. So I've done enough because I own both marketing and product copy that I understand what the tone is. I understand I understand like how to take someone telling me, yeah, we want this to sound friendly, and how to actually make that, you know, into copy. I know like what our headers should look like, what our CTAs should look like. I know all of these things. But yes, I do have a sense of style. And right now I'm building out a style guide that will be used internally. So if someone else was writing an email or whatever, they too could write a DigitalOcean email with copy that is on brand, that uses our particular style when it comes to things like punctuation and grammar and mechanics and all of that stuff. So yeah, that is something that's really important to me. And the resources that I use are the Chicago Manual of Style, 16th edition, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and we also have an internal word list, like how we spell out particular industry-related terms. And I always refer to that.
Yeah, you're speaking my language. My first jobs out of college were writing and editing jobs. And my favorite is the AP style book.
Oh, mine
and
too.
Half of it's like permanently in my head. And I even created a style guide for Bright Umbrella so that, you know, we know what our quote unquote rules are for grammar, our rules are for word choice and active voice and things like that. And, you know, we talk so much. It's like become a trend in this industry to talk about style guides, but almost in terms of like how you apply markup or how you apply different objects to a page. And I feel like this kind of style guide that you're talking about, like an editorial style guide, is also really critical. I feel like every organization, regardless of who you are, should have something that everyone in the organization understands how you convey information through words.
Absolutely. And two that I can think of that I think are great starting points, especially for some of the smaller companies that don't have many writers or maybe even a particular writer on staff. MailChimp has a style guide. I think it's called Voice and Tone. And their content style guide is fantastic. And the awesome thing, too, is that it's open source. So anyone can use it as long as they attribute it to MailChimp and adapt it as needed. 18F, the digital arm of the U.S. government, is really awesome in that they've also created an open source content guide. And it breaks things down like writing and style, but also what different forms of writing are and how to write for them. And I think that's really great, especially for people who don't have an understanding of all of the different aspects or like things that are considered copy, like all of the different, I don't really know, like fields or whatever. So I think that's also a really good starting point.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually leads to the specific questions. What are these examples of copy that you can commonly see on a website?
For sure. Things like, and it's funny, like now I have an eye for it, so I see it everywhere. Things like headers, right? So like things like casing, right? Like you'll see some headers that are title case, and title cases, every word is capitalized with the exception of like articles and prepositions, right? And that conveys a very, very different tone to the user than something that's in sentence casing, which is just the first word is capitalized and then proper nouns. And one of the trends that I've been noticing is how more tech and tech-enabled companies are actually going to the sentence casing versus the title casing, because sentence casing actually reads as friendlier. Mm-hmm. And the product designers that I work with didn't believe me until we sat down and had a two-hour meeting talking about all of the inconsistencies in copy that existed in our application, because different people touched copy at different times before I came in. So we were sitting down to write guidelines specifically for our product. And one of the product designers said, you know, when I was working with you, you gave me all of the headers in sentence casing, and I wasn't really sure what that was about. But when I put it into the design, it actually looked much nicer. It looked friendlier, and it looked like something that I as a user would want to engage with. And I thought, that's really interesting. This is something that people probably think does not matter. Who the hell cares whether the word the is title case or not? But it really does send a message to the user. And the way words appear on a page are affected by trends in every way that, you know, things like parallax scrolling or whatever are trends in visual design.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the different capitalizations and the camel casing. I think I read this article on Medium explaining that sometimes you can choose to do the title casing or camel casing and stuff on purpose to slow down the reader if you want them to read something important. Like, so if it's an alert screen, you don't want it to actually be friendly. You want it to be
Jarring.
And just so they're like, okay, it's in capital letters now. It's important.
Yeah.
You better read this.
Yeah, yeah. It's awesome. And these are, again, these are things that I don't think writers, designers, I don't think many people are really taught to consider when they are producing messaging. So, you know, starting to think about it from like a very analytical POV, I think would be helpful to anyone who's responsible for writing.
I think the same is true for how you use punctuation. You know, there are rules that you learn in grammar school and everything like that, but there's also, you know, an effective use of punctuation can really create emphasis where, you know, someone might not realize how effective setting things off between an em dash is. Like,
yes.
Or putting something in parentheses, like they'd be like, well, that breaks the rules that I learned when I was in fifth grade. But it's like, yeah, but this actually works. Like, look at it. Doesn't it stand out? You know, kind of thing like that.
As long as it's used consistently, that's really yes. all that matters. So right. that's something else that I'll see on websites. So things like casing, right? Even some of the sites, and it's really no one's fault. Sometimes you'll see different, like different pages have mm-hmm. different, you know, they treat their CTAs and their headers with different casing, or, you know, the tone changes a bit. Same thing with punctuation. So it really, so the idea is that it doesn't really matter how you choose to use something as long as you stick with it. So in DigitalOcean blogs, for example, our headlines are all in title casing. Our tutorials are in title casing, and that serves its purpose in that particular form of writing. You know, in the marketing website and in product copy, we want to come across differently. So that wouldn't be as effective there. It doesn't mean that it has to be consistent across all properties, but if you're going to have the marketing website utilize something, make sure that all of the pages there utilize that something, and they use and they treat punctuation, grammar, et cetera, the same way. And similarly, you know, on in all of your properties. And that's actually an easier said than done. Again, I had a 2-hour meeting with product designers just talking about how we treated our H1, H2, H3 headers across the entire product. And that can be a boring conversation, but the truth is it's really, really important because you want the consistency so that people take you seriously, so they understand that you're professional, they understand that you know what you're doing. So if I'm not around, we know exactly, you know, without a doubt, how copy is treated across the board.
Yeah, and it just underscores the importance of having a style guide, especially, you know, for clients who, you know, like we hand over a content management system and they have a staff of 5 people and they all are doing their own thing, and you end up with a site that no longer reflects that. You know, it's subtle, but it does hit you that, oh, this doesn't feel quite as professional because
oh, yes.
it's not consistent. And so having a style guide and really forcing people to refer to it. I mean, one of the things I do for us internally is when, you know, like I assign a blog post to Leia or I assign one to myself, there's a to-do to specifically look at the style guide.
Yep.
Did you follow awesome. All of our rules? You know, just as a reminder that's it's as important to our brand as the look and feel of the website itself.
Absolutely. Totally agree.
And I definitely think it's really important, especially in tech, because different agencies and different products want to speak about technology in different ways. So like if I was talking to my peers, I could use much more technical language to explain how a content management system works. While if I was talking about a content management system to a client or an end user, I'd be using terms like, you can update it yourself.
Right.
Or you can select and press bold, while, you know, to a tech person, we're like, view source, right?
Yes.
So even if you're talking about the exact same subject, the audience really makes a difference in regards to like how you're going to deal with it. So having a style guide explicitly saying, do not use these particular phrases because it's confusing to, you know, a layman, versus like, you should use this because you are talking to a highly technical person and they'll be weirded out or actually confused if you're using layman's terms, conversely.
Yeah, I'm really sensitive to that because at my last job, I was an email marketing writer, and mm-hmm. this particular company has had about 16 markets globally. So we were responsible
wow.
for writing the emails, not just in the US markets, but in our international markets. And all of those
right.
markets utilized British spelling. But it went beyond that. It also went to, like, you know, part of the style of the company is to write really clever, pithy emails.
Right.
And some of the idiomatic expressions we were mm-hmm. using, our counterparts in Australia were like, yo, you got to revisit revisit that because that is not that means absolutely nada here. Mm-hmm. And we were like, oh, that's that. We didn't even think about that. So I'm really sensitive to audiences, especially international audiences, because I know that that's something that we might not consider. But maybe if your company is scaling to a point where, you know, most of your users might be not native English speakers, well, we have to account for that in how we write so that everyone understands, so that the baseline is that it's very clear to just about anyone when they come on the site that what we have is what they're looking for, and we can provide it without adding all of this unnecessary, you know, all of this unnecessary fluff for the sake of, you know, coming across as really cool or really whatever. So yeah, thinking about audiences is a huge thing.
So just stepping back again to the consistency thing. So if there's a style guide in place and, you know, hopefully people are using it, but is there ever a situation or should there be a person who is like the overseer, the editor, who is just ensuring that whatever is going out is up to snuff? Or do you feel like it's one of those things that a style guide can kind of cover that?
That's actually funny because right now I fulfill that role in my job. I'm both copywriter and copy editor, and usually folks will send things to me for a quality check. What I'm hoping to achieve at DigitalOcean specifically is I want to empower employees. So if they have a particular copy question that might seem trivial to some, they can refer to it and they at least feel empowered enough to take a first stab at it, especially if it's a particular form of copy that's outside of my scope, like sales, right? The sales team. I don't touch sales copy, but I want the sales team to understand how we present things so that when they write it, they should still pass it to me, and they typically do, so that I can review and we can send it off. Like, there's going to be things like, you know, maybe an email from a C-level executive or from an account executive to a prospect, you know, that's prospecting, looking for new clients. Like, I want them, that's not really something that I need to touch, but I want them to feel like they have a general understanding of who we are as a company and how we communicate, because the style guide that I'm producing, at least, is doing more than just providing tips on like style and the mechanics of language. I'm saying, hey, this is our audience. This is who DigitalOcean is. This is our voice. This is our tone. This is our personality. When you're writing, whatever it is that you're writing, just keep those things in mind so that whatever messaging you have, you're like, okay, I'm writing as DigitalOcean, which is this. But yeah, a QA process is really, really important. Frequently, I'll get things like emails, sales emails, or even press releases or blog posts that I did not write that will get passed to me because, you know, that QA is really important. So sometimes the person who's writing has the ability to edit, not always. But the short answer is, yeah, if we have like a review process, having an editor who goes in and who can be the person that champions the company style and can be the one to educate people on why certain decisions are what they are, I think that's probably better for everyone.
So that leads me to ask about the particular team collaboration. So a lot of people just pass things on to you, but who do you actually interact with on a regular basis? Like, who on the team, what is their role?
That really depends on the project. So I work with product designers, community managers, product managers, the marketing team. It's really interesting. I sit on the brand design team, and the brand design team is made up of the visual designers in the company. But I'm kind of the one that, because my role is very different from theirs, my process is very different. And I essentially, anyone from the company can reach out to me. I mean, recently I did a project for the people team that had to do with job descriptions. So I interact with just about anyone who knows that I am here at DO. And, you know, if they have any form of, like, as long as they have copy that is like, that falls within my scope, I can write it. And if they don't, then I can edit it.
And what about in your freelance situations? Who are you interacting with typically there?
Yeah, I'm interacting with authors. I'm interacting with web development agencies. So I'm working with like a one-man shop, a consultancy occasionally. I usually work with like much smaller groups of people. So they're usually entrepreneurs or they're consultants, independent business owners, authors, and also like conference organizers. So these are folks who have built or created something. Maybe their writing may or may not be strong. For the editing jobs, yes. Those are typically people that, you know, they are writers and they just come to me for editing. But when I'm meeting with a client that is like a software developer and they created something and they want copy, that's generally someone who doesn't really know copywriting and is coming to me to both educate them as well as produce something.
And is that a a comfortable process for them that you've noticed, or is it uncomfortable? I would feel really uncomfortable handing over our copy to a copywriter. I might recognize a need for it, but it might make me uncomfortable because, you know, it's like my baby. We worked on it. We felt it was good. So have you encountered those situations where it's, I don't even know the word to describe it, but...
resistance?
Yeah, something like that.
You know what? Thankfully, no. The people that have come to me have actually been the ones that are like, you know what? I recognize that my writing is not the best or whatever. Or, you know, some of my clients are software developers in Germany and English is not their first language. So they're like, you know what? Like, we thought we could do it ourselves, but we actually realized that we need help with this. Let me know. You know, they come to me and they're like, you know, we really, they're really eager to have this done because they understand the power of it. And, you know, my role there is to let them know, yes, absolutely, we can get this done. This is how I work. Let's work together on it. I like to be very collaborative about it. Like, I just don't want somebody to be like, can you write this? And then, you know, I give them the final deliverable and that's it. I will say, hey, you know, I did version one of this. Why don't you go in and take a look at it? I usually leave them comments, queries. I query them so that it's a very interactive process. And I find that a lot of people like that and it assuages, you know, some of their fears because I feel like what some people are afraid of is they'll give you the information or they'll give you their writing. They throw it into the ether and they may not hear from you for a while. So I want people to know that, no, the point of copywriting, as with any other form of communication, is that it's communicative. So, you know, I want you to be as much of the process as me. So the people who generally seek out my help are the ones who are like, you know what? I think that someone else could probably do this better. Like, I'm good at this. Let me give this to the subject matter expert.
Yeah, I found a very similar thing for myself when I was working as an editor for Web Standard Sherpa. And even editing our own stuff is that I take an approach where I don't want to tell someone what to do. I want to give them some ideas and feedback and see what they do with it for like the first round or so. And then maybe once they've gone in and applied their ideas, then I'll fine tune. So the first stage of my editing is really more like suggestions. Have you thought about this? This could be stronger. What about this? And just see where they go with it versus me going in and being like chop, chop, chop. You know, making it the way XYZ, the style guide, says it should be. And then later rounds, once they've really taken into account my suggestions and put forth their own ideas, then we get into the nitty gritty of the editing to really tighten things up. Because I feel like writing can be a very personal experience, and an effective editor, at least from my perspective, is not one who wants to make someone feel bad about what they wrote, but more like tell them what was great about it and how they could make it better.
Yeah, absolutely. I also take on a similar approach when it comes to my editing. I always try to remind people that the point of the editor is to champion both the author and the reader.
Right.
So I'm there to make your writing even clearer and more badass for the reader for whatever purpose that we want them to read it. So even when I query people, I'll say, you know, how about we try this? Is it okay to change, you know, or like if they use a word and I realize that it wasn't used properly in context, I'll say, hey, like, you know, what did you mean by this word here? How about we use something like XYZ? Like, I'll give them different words depending on the context. Okay to change. And as long as it sounds like, I never want to sound like I am, you know, like I am an authoritarian figure who's here to tell you this is exactly how things are going to go. Because the author is the one who knows what they're writing more than I do. Right. And I'm just there to use some editing know-how to just make that stronger. And writer and authors respond better that way. You want to champion the writer and you want to champion the reader.
Absolutely.
So,
oh my gosh, I love this episode.
So, I mean, you've had a lot of experience working on all types of copy, like you mentioned, product copy, as well as marketing copy, and then even just regular emails and on and on and on. You must see patterns for common mistakes. What kind of common mistakes do you normally see?
Well, yeah, that's kind of hard. I mean, like we could say like the usual, like, you know, common spelling mistakes. It really, really depends on the project. I hate to say that. But I mean, like with one project, for example, I was recently working with an author and his book is really conversational and it's written in the second person. So everything is a scenario and it's like you're a software developer and this is who you're talking to and this is your colleague. And because of that, you know, there were a lot of like he would put a lot of so's or that or like, you know, specific words in there that come up when you have a conversation. But in writing, they read very awkwardly. So I would go in there and remove phrases that we use that are superfluous in conversation, but that really don't add anything to the sentence. And like, you know, I would remove those, you know, like would be, could be, certain things like, okay, what can we do to kind of condense the sentence and make it more straight to the point? So it really had to. And the reason of that was because he wrote it in the second person, and it's very, and second person is naturally a very conversational style. So just translating the conversational style while keeping it lighthearted, but also like making sure that it was easy to read. So the reader wasn't stumbling over like, you know, really cumbersome phrases and such.
I'm curious, with all the writing that you do, are you ever tasked to get that copy into a content management system or, you know, into templates or the email templates? Is that part of your role, or you would just provide text document and someone else takes it from there?
Currently, it's the latter. I provide a text document and the person who owns that particular project will import it into the CMS or whatever. So if I'm writing something for the website, I will usually, if it already exists, like on the current on the existing website, if there's something that I want to get updated, I talk to the engineer who manages that, because that's in a static site generator. So it's not like I could just go into WordPress and edit it. That does require an engineer who has the credentials to be able to access that. And similarly with like product copy, I give that to the product designers because they're the ones that are responsible for owning that. Email, I work with the email marketing manager, and he's the one who puts in those templates. In a previous job, when I was doing email marketing, initially for the first 4 or 5 months, I was the one who was actually writing, editing, and building the emails out in our email service provider system. And then we moved into a different rhythm where I was just responsible for writing, editing, copy, and we had somebody else building the emails. So it really depends on the size and the needs of the organization. In that particular instance, it's just because it was a quality control issue and it became too much. Like if you're writing, editing, and building the emails, there might be things that you're missing that someone who's just responsible for building the email won't miss.
Yeah.
I feel like we can talk about this subject. Yeah. Well, this is, I feel like I say this all the time in all our shows, but it's so true. There's just so much to talk about. But before we wrap up, what resources can you share to our listeners that will help people write better copy for the web?
Absolutely. There is the Chicago Manual of Style. Pick that up. It's great. If you are overwhelmed by it, check out the Copywriter's Handbook, 3rd edition, which I particularly love. Check out 18f.gov and look for their content guides. They're really great, a really great resource. And also look up MailChimp's content style guide, which is open source, and it'll give you an indication for the different things that you might want to consider when you're building your style guide, and also just managing your website, your email, and all of the various properties that you have.
Awesome.
Perfect. So now we've reached the end of our show, but we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. Are you ready, Stephanie?
I am.
First question, morning person or night owl?
Morning person.
What is one of your guilty pleasures?
One of my guilty pleasures is popcorn. I'll buy a full bag of popcorn and it'll be done by the end of the day.
Yes. What software could you not live without?
Interestingly, Apple Notes, because I can use it from my phone. It's great.
What profession other than your own would you like to try?
Wow. This is really random, but I'd like to be an Olympic race walker.
Oh, I've seen videos of those. It's so
weird. It is so weird, but it is actually hard. I've been like walking 4 to 5 miles a day, and they can walk a mile in like 7 minutes. And I'm like, I'm not good enough to be a gymnast, but I could definitely train to just walk for 20 kilometers.
What profession would you not like to try?
Oh my gosh, that's hard. I wouldn't like to do anything that required like heavy physical. Oh, I wouldn't like to work in a call center. I don't like talking on the phone. I don't like talking on the phone. And if somebody was, and if people were mean to me like 200 times a day, that would absolutely like crush my self-esteem. So no.
If you could take us to one restaurant in your town, where would we go?
Ooh, there's this place called Mama Sushi in Uptown Manhattan, and it's a Dominican and Japanese fusion spot.
Huh.
So their sushi has things like fried sausage, fried cheese, and fried plantain, like in a roll. And it was just, it's the best. I'm Dominican, so I grew up with that food, and seeing it, like, I don't know, in that way was just absolutely fantastic. And I love sushi, so it was great.
If you can meet someone famous, living or dead, who would it be?
I would meet Lady Gaga. First of all, her name is Stephanie. I'm Stephanie. She was born in 1986. So was I. She's from New York. So am I. And I love her personality. I love that she has like a level of musicianship that she doesn't get credited for. And I went to a classical, I'm classically trained. So I really appreciate when you can have pop stars and entertainers that actually have a knowledge of musicianship and musicality.
Mm. If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
If I could have a superpower, it would be teleporting because it would eliminate passports.
Yes.
It would eliminate commuting. So that's hands down.
What is your favorite band or musician?
Oh my gosh, that's hard. My favorite band or musician? I would say one that I always love listening to and that I've been listening to quite a lot recently is Ibeyi, I-B-E-Y-I. They are a duo. They are twin sisters from France. They're Afro-Cuban, and their music is like a very minimalist Afro-Cuban type of music. Like, they're both santera, so they practice santeria, which is a religion that is practiced in Cuba, and it's wonderful because they sing in Yoruba and in English, and their music is just so soothing. They're both 19, and they just have like a wisdom beyond their years.
Hmm. All right, last question. Pancakes or waffles?
Waffles, always. I can sing waffles praises all day. No hate to the pancake folks, but waffles are my jam.
Don't you in New York have that waffles and dingus truck?
Yes, we do. We do. But I'm like, you see, I'm not high class when it comes to waffles. Like, I'll go to a diner and get waffles. Like, I don't really care. As long as it's waffles, Lego my ego, I will. If it's a waffle, I
love
it.
So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining the show, Stephanie.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
They can find me on Twitter at Radio Morillo, or you can find me on my website, StephanieMorillo.com.
This was awesome. Thanks again, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Thank you, Foster Maid.
We'd also like to thank our partners, Arcus Tech and Devotee.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Click Cast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both. And if you really like this episode, consider donating to the show. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we talk to Eric Gillen about overhauling Epicurious. Be sure to check out our schedule on controlclickcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.